Okay. You can just start with the with that anecdote about the White House Drug Abuse Conference. This is 1988.
Yes, the White House Conference for Drug-Free America had its report in 1988, just a very short while before I came back to NIDA. So since I went to NIDA. So because I came to NIDA in March of 88, sometime just in the early months of that year, and the report said something, poetic license, even though this is not poetry, there's a problem with interdiction of the drugs in this country, need to expand the dollars going to the Coast Guard. There's a problem with enforcement domestically, there's a need for increase in the budget of the Drug Enforcement Administration. There's a problem with drug abuse, only the old boys are getting the grants. There needs to be an investigation of NIDA. Well, while I was there, replies were written from NIDA and others. And
who instigated that?
Who instigated the report?
The idea that NIDA needed to be investigated.
Well, I don't know. I wasn't on the White House conference. I was at meetings because of my position, you know, in the Journalist Policy Office in the White House, where certain items were. But that was a real surprise to me, I'm sure most people, when that came out. I don't know. It wasn't a commission like the President's Commission on Mental Health that had commissioners and panels of experts and staff liaisons. They had different meetings and different people spoke. And I don't know if it was even on a public record somewhere that someone had said this. So that had happened, and now I come to NIDA. And my first week there, Bob Schuster says to me, I can't go on this visit that I said I would. Can you go there? Second Genesis. So I go to Second Genesis, and I meet with the director and his staff, and they're telling me about what they do there, and I observe a lot of things. And then I said, how do you know what you do works? Uh-oh. I suddenly thought, here I am in my first week in this job, and I don't think I'm going to get out of here alive. These were primarily individuals, primarily maybe the wrong word, I think they were, but substantial number of individuals who themselves have had drug problems, who themselves now were clean, who knew what had worked for them, and thought if it worked for me, this work can work for others. And what I said when I had a chance, and was supported by Dr. Sidney Shankman in front of his staff, was, I've just come from the White House, and the White House Conference for Drug America has this report. And we need to show that we're effective. It doesn't matter if somebody says there's a problem with interdiction, more funds. There's a problem with enforcement, more funds. We have to show that what we do works. It was actually very important, I think, for me for that to happen my first week. The other important thing that happened for me, too, because certain people said to me, you're going to NIDA? How come you're not going to OSAP or OTI? Not knowing I had been asked to be the director of OSAP. And I said, why? And they said, well, because you're not a research person. So I had said to Bob Schuster that I had no idea that of his background enough to realize what I was saying. I said to Bob, you know, it's very nice that you're asking me for this job. I have to let you know what I think about research. I don't think science should be done just because it's exciting or because it's interesting. I think research is a tool. Use research to find out what works better. And then you apply that in prevention or treatment to affect the lives of people for the better. He said, well, exactly. Like so? You know, I didn't know at the time, you know, where he had started out and his tremendous involvement, you know, in clinics and dealing with patients, but
but that was very, that's his political side agreeing with you. I mean, he agrees with that.
Well, one thing he did not agree with me with was I said to him, why is it that you pay so little attention to AIDS? Only time. The only time I ever can remember that he was angry with me. Now, remember the context. President Reagan, while I was in the Drug Abuse Policy Office, so that's 1987, for the first time mentions the word AIDS. Apparently it had to do with Nancy Reagan and Rock Hudson and different people, but he finally mentioned that word. It wasn't because of the Drug Abuse Policy Office. It just happened to be while I was there. But I knew from the discussions in the Drug Abuse Policy Office and with those of the Communications Office people who would talk to us how this had been a hard sell in a long time. Okay. And the epidemic had been going on for how long by then? I come to NIDA and I say this to Bob Houston. Why do I say what I say? Why does he react the way he reacts? I say, your organizational structure is a proxy measure for what's important to you. And you don't have AIDS anywhere on that chart. He's talking about dollars spent. So I found some very useful lessons just from my very beginnings in coming to NIDA. Not just that Bob would think, okay, here's a guy who can get along with Mac, and Mac is going to be coming back, if Mac would be coming back as administrator. Not just as a guy who has some policy background, and, you know, like you say, you know, the issue about the prohibition on use of federal dollars. But as a guy who could say what he felt he could say, because, see, I always could do this with Mac in a one-on-one. I think that helped the relationship too. Mm-hmm. To know we could be honest with each other. Mm-hmm. I would never say something to put him in an awkward position mm-hmm. somebody else would. Mm-hmm. So that's how I came to NIDA. And how I started out in NIDA.
So how far into his directorship was Schuster at that point, and how much longer did he last?
Well, he stayed another 4 years, almost. He stayed until January of 92. I think he only came around 86.
Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah, so I guess he had been there 2 or maybe not quite 2 full years.
Yes. Yeah. And you did see AIDS become more of a priority within
NIDA. Oh, absolutely. It had become more of a priority. Mm-hmm. Before I went to the White House, so maybe it was in Bob's first year. In fact, I think it was right when he became director. We were given this opportunity from higher levels in the department to say, what would you do if you had an additional $25 million? $25 million was real money in those days, okay? Mm-hmm. And particularly compared to what the budget of NIDA was. And we spent time working together, you know, Bob and some of his people, including Dick Lindblad, me from Mac and some of his people, and crafting together a package. So I had worked with him. Mm-hmm. You know, I knew I could do that. And I'm losing train of thought here. What you asked me, AIDS was a very prominent one. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. Enhanced.
Right. So did you, once you began at NIDA, what kinds of things were you able to affect? What did you do?
I don't think it's unfair to say that Bob relied on me as his inside person for day-to-day management. Mm-hmm. For he had once every other week meeting on a particular day with senior staff. On the alternate week, I met with division directors only mm-hmm. and tried to have the meeting be not what the other one was mostly, which was a sharing meeting. You know, what we were doing, what we had done, what kinds of things we'd be doing, issues that were of interest. And of course, when you have, you know, office directors, division directors, the head of all kinds of other specialists, you're limited to a kind of working meeting in terms of where things were at in sense of, well, gee, if I'm a basic research division and you're a treatment division, I didn't know this, and now that I know that, maybe we can work together on developing a new request for applications or a program announcement or something like that. So I didn't have my own portfolio for the years that I was Bob's deputy. Basically, it gave him more opportunity to concentrate on those things that he wanted to concentrate on, to travel, to even go to things in town that he had felt uncomfortable doing before. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that he and Elaine both did not travel. They both did travel. Mm-hmm. But because his deputy also traveled, the place was operated very differently. Mm-hmm. And I was a guy who would say, I'm the in-house man. Mm-hmm. I'll do these kinds of things. Bob, in some ways, made me uncomfortable because he was too willing to say, you know, Dick, if it's something like, budget or policy, you can do this without me. Mm-hmm. And I'd say, no, Bob. It's a prison. I remember one time he said to me, Goodwin, the administrator, was having a meeting for each institute to present its request for its budget for the next year. And I said, no, Bob. You've got to be there. Even if he were right that I could present it as well or better, even if he were right, it didn't matter. Mm-hmm. To me, the perception of the institute director not being there, instead going to do something else in town, or even, out of town. Mm-hmm. And Bob's view was, just go ahead and do it and tell me later. And, 98% of the time I got back, I said, no. But basically what I did was bring things up to a point where then could present it to him. And I always knew things that I didn't like. One thing I have always not liked is that a staff person who comes to me and says, well, here's option A and here's option B. And I say, where's option C through H that you looked at and then decided you didn't want to bring to me? Mm-hmm. And so I would bring those up to Bob. And after a while, he said to me, Dick. Okay. So, you develop that relationship, but I never wanted to assume anything.
Yeah.
But I did not have my own portfolio.
Yeah.
I did have my own.
Did you... I assume the advisory council was active during that time. Did you facilitate that at all? Was that an effective council?
I'm trying to remember, and I'm afraid I'm going to confuse it with something. While I was in Adama, in the office of the director, we established an extramural science advisory board. And I asked to be executive secretary because I had my own views on how this might work and really not just be one of these meetings where you come, you're acknowledged, you say your piece, you think it's brilliant, but now people acknowledge it, just acknowledge that you've spoken actually, and then call on the next person who's talking about something mm-hmm. else and mm-hmm. no one ever gets to that. I can't remember what my role was in the... I think I was... the chair of the National Advisory Council on Drug Abuse. I know that I chaired the closed sessions to review grant applications. But I was at NIDA so many years. Did this actually start when I first came there?
I think it was established before.
I don't.
It was the deputy. Do you remember it as effective? Is it?
I love council. Uh-huh. And I think we use council well mm-hmm. because... we didn't just say, of course now I'm not going to know what years these are. If it's Schuster's years,
or
my 2 years as acting director, or Leshner years. But I remember we had real discussions, even in the closed session, reviewing a grant application for a female condom. What was the priority score? If we went in straight priority score order, would we fund it? This was the second time this application had come in. It was an amended application. If it went back again, would it be improved? And in the meantime, if you're not going to fund it and you're not going to start the work on it, what are you losing in public health terms? I mean, I loved council because they would look not just at research or scientific merit, if you will, but public health implications. Mm-hmm. And since I myself come from that kind of background and can resonate with that, I like that. But it was also interesting, the council, it wasn't just the non-scientific members who had that point of view.
Yeah.
I love council and subcommittees of council. I ran afoul early on of a subcommittee of council dealing with administration of drugs to humans. Actually, it wasn't early on. It had started while Bob was director. And its final report came to me when I had just become acting director. And then I involved myself a lot more in it than I had, because I really had not involved myself in it. and asked a lot of questions of some people, because it was basically made up of people in council. Really, I think, may have even felt it as an affront after they had done all this work, and I'm asking questions at a later point.
And how had you run afoul of it? I mean, what was the...
I think, you know, it was a group process that had taken a long time, and they came up with this consensus in this report, and the director had blessed it, but it hadn't been signed off on. And then there's this new person now saying, well, you know, it's going to be my signature on this now. I want to make sure that I really understand.
Yeah.
And because I am not a researcher, I may have a different view. And of course, because I'm a lawyer, people look at that and say, well, is this guy going to have this legalistic view of what we can and cannot do? Yes and no. I do believe that you have to administer drugs of abuse to humans. I can give you all the caveats, and you know that some of them are there, you know, not if they're naive to drugs, you know, particular age, other kinds of factors, but I believe you have to do that in order to learn what works, that it's a moral imperative to do that for the greater good. But I do recognize the individual role, and not that they didn't, but the fact that I had raised a question, I think, man, who is this person? We've known as deputy director, but not in this role.
Yes.
And who is he to ask, and why is he asking?
Was there an insider-outsider kind of tension there?
I certainly wasn't aware of it then. The fact is that, as I soon learned after coming to NIDA, and did not know before that, really started out as a very small cadre of individuals. And the fact that some of them wound up marrying each other made it an even more intimate kind of group. But the fact is that these people were the experts in their fields. So not to have them would have been criminal in terms of the best minds and the best science. But sure, there were relationships of longstanding there that I didn't understand and never was going to.
What were the primary tensions during those Schuster years?
Oh, let's see.
Within the
medications
divisions.
Development was one.
And why was that a tension?
It was a tension because were we going to go into the pharmaceutical business? Were we going to try to convince the pharmaceutical industry to do something here? If we got a medication, was it going to be effective when given to individuals with multiple problems and with motivation to try to get drugs anyway, many of them. In terms of medications, at that time in the entire pharmacopoeia of thousands of drugs approved by FDA, we had methadone. And we had naltrexone, 002 medications. And naltrexone worked for a very small group of individuals who really had a lot to lose because they hated taking it. But, you know, so we had methadone. And methadone, when did I come to NIDA? 88? We've had more than 20 years of methadone and still have all of this baggage that comes with it. And in fact, methadone, I think, is a wonderful illustration maybe of why we had to have a medications development program. I say we, but it was Bob Schuster, okay? Methadone had a role as a I'm trying to think of the class of drug that it is.
Oh, it's just an opioid.
But it was marketed for a particular use. And then once it became associated with drug abuse, it was the pharmaceutical company kind of...
Could no longer use it for pain.
Could no longer use it for pain. I mean, is that what it is?
It's a regular opiate. It was used for pain.
Okay, it was used for pain management. It kind of lost that, you know, and In those days, did we talk yet about orphan drugs? I don't know. Probably we
not
did.
Not quite. Well,
not quite? Okay.
I thought it was later.
Okay, I don't remember. So, you know, what's the market going to be? And if pharmaceutical companies aren't going to do this, then okay, we're going to do it. But if we do it, and then we find a drug, we're not going to market it. We'll have some pharmaceutical company do it. And then what? Have Congress bring us in? Why we used federal dollars to develop a medication that now a for-profit company is using to make money? Mm-hmm. So we knew some of the challenges that were going to be there.
And I assume a lot of this was, I mean, you had buprenorphine as a, that was a concrete example of this. I assume.
Buprenorphine was not administered for drug abuse by 88. It was
right.
Only approved.
Yes.
It was only approved somewhere between 92 and 94.
Yeah, but it had been studied Lexington.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, in the 70s.
But I mean, it wasn't approved. It wasn't an approved pharmacotherapy. Right. So I think those were some of the issues. Now, Schuster, you know, was the guy who got idea with the man with the idea, and the administrator, Goodwin, supported this. And then, you know, is it a medications development program? Is it a medication development something else? Medications development was something that was very specifically decided upon as terminology.
I hadn't realized it was so contested.
Which part?
The development of a medications development division.
Well, am I indicating it was contested? I'm just indicating some of the issues that we thought about.
That it was one of the biggest,
that we thought about.
You know, I mean, when I asked what were the primary tensions, that's
the first
thing you said, so it's been interesting.
I thought you meant the actual nomenclature. No, that was just interesting, but nothing. I don't even know if people, if you'd ask other people, they would say those were the tensions. I was responding to a question you asked me, but mm-hmm. certainly those were all the threads, the mm-hmm. strands mm-hmm. that came together. Who do you have run this? Somebody from industry or somebody from inside? Do you recruit somebody? What is the knowledge you need to have? Now, clearly, the Cancer Institute had a medications development program, but the Cancer Institute also did kinds of things that if NIDA did it, you'd say, how can you do that? Those are services functions.
Yeah.
All right.
So NIDA had to be very careful to avoid any services.
Yes. So, you know, we mentioned AIDS, we mentioned medications development. Now, one theme throughout those years, 88 to 92, was this continuing tension in drug abuse between services and research. We now had the Office for Treatment Improvement, the Office of Substance Abuse Prevention, and three institutes, NIDA, Mental Health, and Alcohol, that comprised Adam. The programs administered by OTI and OSAP had been NIDA programs. Mm-hmm. The staff that went with the programs had been NIDA staff.
Yes. And not everybody was thrilled about the separation between...
Not everybody was thrilled about the separation. I, for one, in terms of my personal views, but they don't have anything to do specifically with the separation into OSAP and OTI, but in my view of accountability and responsibility, think it's much better to have one agency that looks at the entire human being with all these functions, services, research, prevention, training, so that nobody can say, well, that's, I'm not really accountable for that. I'm accountable for research. Mm-hmm. But that has nothing to do with at that time what was happening. But I was sensing acutely that from meetings that I would go to as deputy director with people from other components, and it wasn't hard to see. It was a tremendous tension, part of OTI and OSAP, that they were not treated equivalently to institutes. And I will say that when Fred Goodwin distinguished between so-called type A and type B demonstrations, that...
And when was that?
Oh, this had to be... '85, '86. That the services components could only do services demonstrations. They could not do research demonstrations. Those were the province of the institutes. That it made things even more difficult. And because these components had come out of a couple of ribs of NIDA, there was a problem. And as you know, there were some services functions that resided in NIDA, people maintained, which eventually, when SAMHSA was set up, additional programs were moved from NIDA and transferred to SAMHSA. So that tension was there. The other tension, I think, although when I got there, it was not really an issue anymore. So I'm sure people say I'm wrong. Involving the parent movement, using the parent movement, I think things were an awful lot better by then. Now, having said that, anybody reading this would say, how can he say things were better? Isn't that in part why there was a White House conference for a drug-free America? You know, isn't that why McDonald became administrator? Isn't that why Schuster was chosen, at least by, who can ever know the whole, not truth, but everything going on, but to what we knew, wasn't that why? You don't just prove yourself through that. I think another issue was cigarettes. To what extent would NIDA be involved in cigarettes, or was that outside the purview of drugs of abuse? Well, that's a lot already, I think, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Okay. Yeah. All right, so would you say, you become acting director after Schuster leaves, and that's in?
January 92.
92. So you're acting director 92 to 94.
Four March, 26 months.
Okay. And so would you say the same tensions remain, or do others
crop in? No.
What do you try to do as acting director?
Different tensions. The first tension is, who knew I'd be there for 26 months?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Anybody in an acting position has a tension between, am I going to focus on acting, that is, not make major decisions that preempt my successor or director, actually do those kinds of things that need to be done. So that was one series of tensions. The second tension was, directly related to being acting director, was that there were three announcements for this job advertisements. The second one was aborted after a week or two. I don't know what happened there. But the first one occurred while we were part of Adam Hunt. And the second one while we were part of NIH. So a major issue was we became part of NIH while I was acting director. You might even say again became part of NIH because whatever kernel of drug abuse was within NIMH. Okay. A third part relates to, as we became part of NIH, there was this looking under a microscope at NIDA again and saying, well, we looked at you during the time OTI and OSEP performed, and now we're going to see what else has to come out. And, some of that was epidemiology, and some of that were the services demonstrations and some other kinds of things. And I had to, if you will, negotiate about that as acting director.
Mm-hmm. About what would stay and what would go.
Yes, which was rather awkward because Goodwin by now had left. He had made his unfortunate comments in February 1988, just before I became NIDA acting director, at an advisory council meeting. And Elaine Johnson became acting administrator. Elaine and I have known each other for many years, respect each other, but nonetheless, I think I can say in all candor, it was a very difficult position. She is my supervisor. Somebody else is now acting director of OSAP. And is Elaine the arbiter between myself and that other person? And I felt that I had to go to the Assistant Secretary for Health to raise certain issues that I thought were in need of a of an objective, a more objective assessment. Mm-hmm. So those were the issues there, becoming part of NIH. What does that mean? Clearly it means NIDA is research, but did everybody agree that NIDA should just be research? I told you my own views about
the irony
what this
of
means.
You being in that position at that time. Who made, how did the decision get made for NIDA to go into NIH?
Well, there had been a proposal the year before for there to be an ADAMSA, an Alcohol, Drug Abuse, and Mental Health Services.
That would have been 91? Or was that earlier?
Probably, but I'm not sure. Well, let's see. The first time I spoke as acting director before the CPDP was in June of 92. And I know I said in that talk last year when we were here, we were talking about an ADAMSA. So sure, that would have been 91. That would have elevated the status of these services components, but still kept us all within one umbrella. And the name would have said services. We had been HISMA a long time ago. But now, we're research. And what were those forces? I don't know. I mean, I do know that different people in the Institute, the administrator, did not like what was happening here. I mean, see, what was happening, maybe I haven't said that, just like Bob Schuster had to deal with the parents' movement early on, Bill Pollan, I'm sure, did too before that, Fred Goodwin was being confronted by people saying, drug abuse is being treated too much in an ivory tower, you know? These other components, the service components, need to be elevated. We need to have one of them become the head of it. So I'm sure that that was part of the reason that, Fred, at least, I'm sure, would say that was a problem and why he didn't want that. The services. Now, what actually happened? I don't know. We did know, however. You hear all these kinds of reports. So, I mean, it's not first-hand information, but it seemed to have good provenance at the time, that the then director of NIH was very interested in having NIMH returned to NIH. Wasn't sure about alcohol, but did not want the Drug Abuse Institute, based on his perceptions, I'm sure, about what research does NIDA do. Is this research classically as NIH would do? But I can skip all that because when it happened and it was a fait accompli and there was a new director of NIH who was very welcoming of drug abuse and drug science, Bernadine Healy, that issue wasn't presented. A lot of people, I feel, felt at the time, gave Bernadine Healy a bad rap. She wanted to deal with strategic planning, and people said, you can't have a planning process. She wanted to talk about gender-specific medicine, and people had comments about that. She wanted to talk about clinical research, and people had comments on that. So, not surprisingly, people said, well, she doesn't really care about drug abuse research. She just wants to build her empire. I mean, we were not going to build her empire. Yes, our three institutes together account for a sizable, amount of dollars and whatever, but it certainly wouldn't have made her her leadership any easier, and the dollars were bringing it to a new level. She also said something, which maybe because I agree with, I found not offensive. I was at one of my early NIH Institute director meetings as acting director. And Vera Dean Healy said something to the effect, it's not a quote, but she did use this image. She said, if I wanted to fund grant applications in priority score order, I could have monkeys, I wouldn't need institute directors. Well, I laughed. And then I saw suddenly, oops. Of course there had been a whole history and a development of a culture with those other institute directors and Dr. Healy. But to me there was a truth there, because that was my thinking. But I never would have phrased it that boldly or baldly or perhaps offensively. What I said was that we are the stewards within NIDA. We're the stewards of federal dollars. And something that's going to get a 118 priority score may be the 98th iteration of something that we know, and it's fine. But as a public health agency, there are so many other areas that haven't been funded and that we need to start. Maybe this fits with my female commune kind of thing. Okay, but Bernadine Healy, so what were the issues? For me as acting director with Bernadine Healy, I never had any issues with her in terms of her motivation or in terms of her acceptance of drug abuse science. And of course. The issues I really had were leading up to that, you know, with the decision on what programs are going to remain with NIDA. And I had a fight for Lloyd Johnston's Monitoring the Future grant, because it was a grant in an R1 and something looking at causes, the correlates, consequences of drug abuse, and a longitudinal study over time. Whereas I did not fight for the Drug Abuse Warning Network or the National Household Survey of Drug Abuse, despite the fact that you could do lots of good research, particularly from the lab, and a lot of it is being done. The demonstrations, well, that was just deciding on a definition of what would fit the type A versus the type B. And finally, going back to the first thing I said, being acting versus director, you have no choice. You have to be director. Things are moving, you have to make decisions. In my case, decisions on new program priorities, which and I thought you couldn't have too many. That is, you had to limit them. And in our case, one was clinical neuroscience, including the burgeoning field of brain imaging, and the other was advancing the field of behavioral therapies.
So, about the clinical neuroscience versus the behavioral, at that time, would you have seen those as in tension with one another?
As intention?
In tension with one another?
No.
Or
no, not at all, because behavioral hadn't even been developed. Mm-hmm. It was really basic phase one kinds of studies. Hadn't even gone.
And you mean things like contingency management? Or cognitive behavioral therapy, or
these are all kinds of programs that you can apply to mental health, mm-hmm. but they hadn't been applied mm-hmm. to drug abuse. We had a scant number of surveys at the very beginnings, and we're just asking those questions that you need to get answers to upon which to proceed. So I didn't see a competition. If there were a competition, the competition would have been between how much of the budget goes to basic research versus how much of the budget goes to all else.
Okay. Applied, or how do you what do you differentiate from basic?
Well, if I just would say basic versus everything else at that point, it probably was at one point 50-50. And while we were under Adam Ha, it seemed as if at least mental health had a much higher proportion going for basic research. I wouldn't raise that to the level of attention, but it just explained the difference in a field. I wasn't looking at what the breakdown in dollars should be. I was looking at what hasn't been funded. But by suggesting two areas, both of which are not basic research, that might have tilted that balance even more so, such that basic research would be less than 50%. I don't know, there's some mystique when you become a director, even an acting director. People who would talk to me all the time when I was deputy director wouldn't talk to me as freely when I was acting director. So I had to find those people who would, and there were many fewer, to really be honest about what was actually happening in the field and what the perceptions were. But the other, and the other thing I thought I had to do was to prove our bona fides that we really were an NIH institute. And there, because of the AIDS epidemic, it made no sense to me to think of enhancing some effort already underway in the expanding lab.
Now, was there an attempt to attract neuroscientists to working on drug abuse? Or was the clinical neurosciences division that you were interested in expanding, that was already people who were within the field?
We didn't have very much. I mean, Nora Volkoff, ask her today, will talk about her attempts to be funded and how she wasn't funded on her first attempt and revising applications and what was happening. And I don't know if I can say that in 1992 we spoke about a clinical neuroscience apparatus or a clinical neuroscience program, no, or that cadre of researchers called clinical neuroscientists. I think that came into play and maybe into vogue a little bit later, albeit the 1990s was the proclaimed decade of the brain.
Yes, yes. So under Alan Leshner, that was became
Alan had
more
much
pronounced.
More in terms of neuroscience focus. Yes.
So were there grantee concerns, like among the NIDA grantees, were there concerns about them not being competitive with other NIH, like with
Absolutely.
NIH review committees? And where did this come from? Were they realistic?
Well, there's always fear of the unknown. But here, just as I knew that Dr. Hiller's predecessor was not excited, to use a euphemism, about drug abuse research coming into the NIH, so too did researchers doing that test. And I thought, and I'm sure they did too, that Dr. Billy is new. But it's going to take a while for that culture and climate of NIH senior leadership in the office of the director to turn around, because they know what what her predecessor thought. When we were in Adamha, we had a separate review process administered by Adamha. We were not part of the NIH process except for referral. All grants and applications that came into our institutes, even when we were not part of NIH, went to what was then called a Division of Research Grants. And then the assignments were made to us. So now we were going to be using NIH review committees. Now this is the irony, sad irony, if nothing else. While I am trying to meet with institute directors at NIH to display to them and convince them that drug abuse science is the equal of that of other institutes, the NIDA researchers are concerned that if their grant applications are reviewed through NIH by NIH-funded scientists who are on the review committee, they will fare less well. Well, that's a dilemma, It put me in. What does that say about drug abuse science, somebody might have said to me, if your own researchers fear to come into the system? Well, there was a lot of work, and a lot of... I met with every NIDA IRG member. I met with our advisory boards. I tried for transparency as much as I could. we had sessions at the neuroscience annual meeting, which was in Washington, one of those 2 years, the year most applicable to the timing that we're dealing with here. It had a session during which I and other people from, you know, NIH proper, you know, spoke together, Neurology Institute, for example, another neuroscience institute. Had discussions about what to keep within NIDA as NIDA-specific review committees, for example, medications development, mm-hmm. for example, services research. I also felt, although this is not the best way of convincing somebody, that you still are going to have lots of NIDA research funded for this reason. Whatever the best applications we received, we would fund. Now, however, having said that, if these applications are normed against a universe that includes those from other institutes, and now suddenly the best NIDA application is in the 25th percentile, what would that say we're funding? Are we funding to the 45th percentile suddenly? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The tensions about funding were, of course, about that, but also about dollars, of course. We hadn't gone into the doubling yet, and we were in one of these periodic waves where things had increased dramatically in drug use. While Schuster was there, you know, whether he wants to claim credit for it or not, what did the budget go up? Fivefold or something, like from $85 million to 300 and something million in short order, and then it's flattening. Well, you know what that means. When budgets are flat, and you take your continuing, non-competing continuations, how much is left for new? And in terms of how much is left for new, how much of that is going to go to those clerical boys, and how much is going to go for new people? And that's, of course, one reason why you do have new either RFAs or program announcements to say, hey, we're going to set the dollars aside, or we're going to tell you right now this is a priority for us to go into these areas. Now, I'm talking to you, and of course I was director for over 2 years, but you know, processes are such that each process can take 2 years. Mm-hmm. For example, here we are in the summer of 2008, and the federal fiscal year 2008 is just about to be over, and October 1st, fiscal 2009 will be starting, and by next January, barely 6 months from now, the agencies will have to give their fiscal year 2010 budget. So you're always working with three budgets. The same kind of way, when I'm talking about a program announcement, sure, that doesn't take that long to develop, but once it's announced, it's going to take 9 months or more to make applications. You have to wait for your first receipt date, right? 3 or 4 months, and then your IRG has to review it, and then your council has to approve it, and then you have to have the dollars to make the awards. So really, those kinds of things that I can say, if you will, I was intimately involved in starting, have their actualization later down the road.
Yes, yes. So can you tell me You actually stayed on after Alan Lishner came in.
Yes. What happened was, of course, Rob Schuster asked me to be his deputy director. When Alan came on, I said to him, if you'd like me to step aside, of course, I'll do that. And in trademark Lishner fashion, he said, what, are you crazy? Well, of course, you know, he did. I was useful to him in the beginning. Introducing him to the drug abuse research community.
Yeah, because he was coming from outside.
He came from outside, he came from NIMH. He actually went to CPDD the summer before he was director. He was a candidate for the job at that point. I had known Alan. I mean, he was deputy at NIMH, I was deputy at NIDA. When he came there from the NSF, he had started this monthly lunch club of the three ADAMHA Institute, the ADAMHA Research Institutes. He and myself and a guy named Lauren Archer from Alcohol Institute. You know, I knew Alan. And at that point, I was introducing him to some of the drug abuse people. But when he was director, he had a very different style than Schuster did. very different style. And he was intimately involved in everything that was going on. Mm-hmm. Alan had a different dynamic on how things, you know, were done. And we were a terrific team this first couple of years, anyway. I'm very comfortable in being a number two person. Some people are not. And it's not that I have no ego, but I guess it's like when I was talking about when McDonald came in and saying, sure, I have certain things that I'm interested in, but I think what I'm here for is to help you accomplish what you want to accomplish. Now, Alan, of course, already had those kinds of skills, very different, but I mean in terms of, you know, knowing who I am and in terms of, you know, working on issues. And under Alan, I became much more involved in, among other things, let's say, dealing with staff and morale issues. And Alan used me, along with the executive officer, who also had stayed from Schuster.
Who was?
Laura Rosenthal.
Yeah.
And his head policy person, who he hired, Tim Condon. Mm-hmm. Eventually, kind of as a group of three that, if I'm on paper, it never seemed it would work because nothing was defined who would do what. But we all knew what each of us was going to do. And when the three of us met with Alan in the morning, each morning, it was just enough that we all knew what to do and who was going to do what. It's hard to explain, but it just worked. It wouldn't for somebody else. After I was there a year, after he was there, I said to Alan, okay, you know, I've been here. You now know drug abuse, you know the drug abuse field, you know. I'm offering my resignation. And he said, no, I want you to stay. So I did stay. But there were different kinds of things, you see, at that point, that I became hungrier for. It was during that time that I became the, along with being acting director, deputy director of NIDA, acting director of Division of Epidemiology, Prevention, and Services Research. Mm. It was during that time that I was offered the positions deputy administrator of SAMHSA and thought hard about it but turned it down. Mm. So
what did you do next? After you eventually...
I was with Alan the whole time Alan was there.
Yeah.
So he left before I did. I saw myself for a part of the time, his early time, as somebody to be able to give policy advice on any area. And there were certain areas that I ran directly, the women's program, the special populations program, mm-hmm. The correspondence, which sounds kind of meager, but basically how we portray ourselves.
Had women's and special populations greatly expanded during that time?
The women's program was very tiny and essentially just gained, I think, credibility. And I wound up writing an article on our women's program for the first issue of the Journal of Gender-Specific Medicine. The special populations program, yes, it did grow markedly. And it grew markedly in part because I brought it into the Office of the Director, and specifically under my jurisdiction, because I felt that it really wasn't going anywhere in terms of respect and in terms of, well, that's a strong word, but I think that's fair to say. So with Alan, I mean, I got involved in everything because he got involved in everything. And again, because I'm somebody who didn't have to have my own program, that was fine. But you see, after a couple of years, you start saying, well, you know, what is this going to be like? Under Bob Schuster, for 4 years as deputy director. 4 years? Yeah. Since I really felt I ran day-to-day operations with his blessing, it wasn't something that ever became stale. When you're acting director, suddenly you're in a new level of doing things that maybe you haven't been doing before. So to go back to a deputy director, it's okay because of who I am and what I like to do. But after a couple of years, I thought, well, you know, what else can I do here? And I started thinking about different kinds of things. Basically, I guess you'd call them your think tank kinds of operations. When Alan left, well, okay, that's where that was at that point. When Alan finished 4 years, we had a half day or more meeting in his house. Alan, Tim, Laura, and myself were basically, I had formulated it as what are the themes going to be for Leshner's second term, you know, and thinking ahead to that. But it was during that time that I personally found it rewarding to be acting director of the epidemiology division, and to, because I had never done that. I had never done a division. I had done an office, and I had been responsible for, you know, decisions on planning, on policy, but here actually to meet with your program officials and to sit with them as they were looking at applications and deciding which ones they wanted to recommend for me. I think I tended to spend more and more of my time in the division when Alan left, I still was acting division director.
So you went on doing that for how long after that?
Well, then Glenn Hansen came in as institute director. When I had been asked to be acting director after Bob Schuster left, we were part of Adam High. And now we were an NIH institute, and I don't know what considerations went into deciding to have a scientist as acting director. I mean, clearly, I know at that point, with the exception of the National Library of Medicine, I was the only deputy director, and of course not no directors, who did not have an MD or PhD. And I certainly was very unusual. And of course, I can talk science. And one of my strengths is to be able to know, to be able to speak to different audiences who are not scientists. And there are certain areas of science that I can understand. Clinical science, for example. When you get into some of the basic, I can have an understanding enough to defend it before a congressional committee and some audiences, but I never would presume to be a scientist. I mean, Alan Leshnikov was always saying that I was raising an issue that nobody else would raise, you know, about that I'm not a scientist. But when it came to me find somebody to be acting director at NIH, of NIDA in NIH. NIH chose Glenn. So Glenn was acting not quite as long as I was, but probably from December through April, plus a year. Yeah, I'd say 17 months. But I spent most of my time by then on epidemiology, prevention, and service researchers. Of course, there's a tension there. How can you play both roles? How can you truly represent a division when then you have to be on the other side deciding on things? I think I did that role actually pretty well, but it meant that it would have been done better if they were two separate people. Maybe.
So when did you stop working for NIDA?
Okay. Nora Volkoff came to NIDA in May of 2004. I had known Nora as a researcher, as somebody who is a brilliant researcher and an outstanding communicator of research. when it was announced that she was going to be director, I called her and congratulated her and said I would come up to Stony Brook and meet with her whenever she liked, and she said it wasn't necessary. I said whenever she came down, if she wanted to meet. I think there were other people who were guiding her. I mean, Glenn, Alan Leshner, you know, maybe some others. And when she came, I don't think that she got, because it's not easy to get, why Alan had this group of Laura and Tim and myself, and what were the specific roles that each of us had. And it became clear that she wasn't going to use me in the role that I really wanted, which was principal advisor to her. She still has a policy office, but I don't mean that. Just somebody kind of like in that role that I mentioned with McDonald, or her parties, who, when he became director of NIMH, was interviewing me to see if I wanted to be special assistant to him. And what he told me was, you know, if you run something small, you can do it yourself. If you run something large, like NIMH at that time, you need somebody just to be able to sit in a room and be told that's crazy. So I wasn't going to have that relationship with Nora. But she was the one who took the action in October and said to me that she wanted to reorganize. And as I listened to her, I said, I don't think you want to reorganize. I think you want to choose your own deputy. And you know what? That's absolutely appropriate. I offered it to Alan Leshner when I came in a year later. You know, in retrospect, I'm sorry I didn't offer that up to you. And she offered me a different job there, and I thought, well, maybe I better think about what I want to do when I grow up. So I did.
So does that bring the story to a close? Or
well, it brings the NIDA.
It opened NIDA another
years.
Chapter.
It brings my NIDA years to a close, but before I went to Catholic University, I wound up going to the Fogarty Institute. Its official name is the John E. Fogarty International Center for Advanced Policy Studies or something like that. And when I was there, I was able to draw some linkages between Fogarty and NIDA that hadn't existed before. And when I came to Catholic University, you don't forget who you are, and what you are remains as something that drives you. What I said I wanted to do there was to teach a course on drug use policy. And I have developed a course with the ungainly name of Drug Abuse, Public Health, and Public Policy Considerations, which I teach in the fall. I teach another course on health policy, broader issues, in the spring. And I'm very pleased that there's no medical school at Catholic University, but I have had in my class social work students, law students, psychology students, nursing students. So it really is interdisciplinary, and that I feel I'm able to take people who will be the leaders in those professions and have them understand drugs, drugs of abuse, and their effect on people and what makes people tick. So I think the drug abuse story continues.
Yeah, great. Great ending, too. Actual closure.
All right, super.
Yeah, no, that was very nice. Thank you.